This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Wonderful to have you with us for a brand new episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Pets and Vets, one of the busiest hours on your radio. It was Dr. Hannah Rowles who was with us from the St. Vincent Group. She was taking your questions and explaining why it is so important that as the temperatures rise, we need to keep our cats and dogs cool. But how? She had some fantastic ideas. We had a duo of authors on the show. One, looking at introducing our kids to cultural hotspots around the UAE. She thinks that the country is our classroom and wants you to go out exploring with her scavenger hunts and information packs. And Bika was talking to us from Greenfeet Guides. And it was Shaheen Shisti who was on the line explaining why his new book is all about empowering women and making sure our granddaughters have the future that he hopes. And with so many changing rules, we were going behind the headlines with Emily Jenkins from Donata Travel. She was on hand to explain the latest guidelines, offering up some recommendations and some brilliant deals too. So whether you're staying here in the UAE, going further afield, or just waiting on that announcement, this is essential listening. Plus the app that is changing the way we book and pay for our travel. Can you imagine paying after you've taken the flight? That's exactly what they're proposing.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
It is the highlight of the listening week for all of you animal lovers, pets and vets here with Dr. Hannah Rowles and the SV Group. And today we're focusing on heat, keeping your animals safe and entertained during the course of the afternoon and the summer indeed. And loving the photos you're already sending in. We've had Luca and Chaplin. Oh my goodness, these kittens. Xena, can we please do a show where I just have like puppies on the floor of the studio and like a cat on my lap in an evil genius fashion?
Not sure if I can make that happen, but I can try.
Helen. A hamster? I'd settle for a rodent of the cute variety.
Oh no.
Go on, have a chat. Go and have a chat with the boss.
Sure. Right,
thank you. So what we want to know from you this afternoon is, do you have any concerns, any worries about your pet? Maybe you want a second opinion. Maybe you are noticing some behaviours or symptoms that just aren't making sense. Joining us today is Dr. Hannah. All topics up for grabs. Dr. Hannah, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Well, I'm a bit warm. On a daily basis. Otherwise,
I went to Top Golf last night. By the way, I am rubbish at golf. Also, more rubbish wearing denim. What was I thinking?
We've passed denim territory, haven't we? Really, I think
it's all about the wafty dresses from now on. I'm just going to waft around. But it is it's a hot time for us humans, and it's definitely a hot time for the animals as well. I'm noticing, you know, dogs going out for their walks earlier on in the morning, later on in the evening. Cats perhaps not, you know, lounging out on balconies and gardens as long as they used to be. So what do we need to do as responsible pet owners as we come into the summer season here in the UAE?
I think that the first thing that we would like to stress as vets is that our dogs and cats work a bit differently to us. So they are more sensitive to the heat than we are. So if we are feeling warm, they are feeling extremely warm. So we must always bear that in mind, and we want our pet owners to be sort of hypervigilant, if you will, about how the heat is affecting our pets. Our dogs and cats don't sweat the way we do. They don't have the ability to do that. They only have sweat glands in their feet. So we always notice that when they're on the consult table, and you get little sweaty paw prints when they're nervous, but they don't have sort of the capacity to do that the way we do. So they cool down by panting or open mouth breathing, which is just not as efficient as we can. So they really are more sensitive to the heat. They're also lower to the ground. So they have the heat radiating up off the ground. So if they do feel the heat even more than we do, we have a bit of distance from our feet, luckily. So there's that. They're also wearing fur coats, essentially. And a lot of our dogs and cats are black, so they just absorb all that heat. You know, they're really not equipped to deal with it. So if we are feeling the heat, it is sort of multiplied for them. So you just can't be too careful.
You really can't. It can be incredibly serious. It can lead to fatalities. So keeping them inside, being, you know, checking the ground if you're taking your dog out for a walk, you know, putting your back of your hand off, taking your flip-flop off, and lots of hydration.
When you go for a walk, exactly, all that kind of stuff. And if you're worried, don't go. You know, they will survive not having a walk. You can do a scavenger hunt in your garden, or, you know, let them have a little sniff and get their interaction that way. They will be fine without that big walk. You might get yourself into trouble if you push it and it's mm-hmm. too warm.
Can I ask you, if you do take them out and it's too long or it's too hot, what are some of the signs in dogs in particular, I'm talking about, of heat stroke, heat exhaustion, and what do you do in that moment to make sure that they're going to be okay?
Get them out of the heat. So the first sign that we'll see is more rapid breathing and them trying to pant. And of course, they only have so much capacity to do that panting, if you see what I mean. Often if their feet are too hot, they will kind of pretty much hop, which is interesting to see with all four legs, but they will shift from one foot to the other to try and keep that, get off that contact from the hot ground. So if you're noticing anything like that, and more rapid breathing than you would normally expect, you know, especially if they're only walking slowly, any of those symptoms, we need to just get them out of the heat, stop them moving, because of course that's burning more energy and heating them further, and try and get them to drink, to hydrate, and to cool down. We don't necessarily recommend getting them to drink really, really cold water, because that can sort of make them quite shocked. But also if you're really worried that they're overheating, the first thing to do is phone the vets and tell them that you're on your way, but also maybe put a towel in water and put the towel over the dog's shoulders, because as the water evaporates, it dissipates the heat from the dog. So that's the best way of doing it, rather than, say, throw a bucket of water over them. Heat the towel, and that's more effective. Wet the towel, even. Don't heat the towel.
No.
Don't heat the towel. Wet the towel. Wet the towel on the hot dog.
Hot dog.
Yes.
Wet the towel on the hot dog. That's our advice this afternoon on Pets and Vets. I wanted to ask you about, you already kind of alluded to it, about indoor activities. And there are some great kind of gadgets and games and things. What's been popular with patients and pooches and cats as well, to keep them physically stimulated but mentally stimulated too? Because especially dogs, they get an awful lot of scent and stories and interaction, socialising when they go out for their walks. But if those are being, you know, tapered down a little bit, how can they still be getting some stimulation at home?
There are activity pads and packs and sort of activity mats that you can make if you don't want to buy, but also you can buy as well. I particularly like the idea of a snuffle mat, where you can hide bits of kibble and hide treats in the snuffle mat and they have to find it. You can, of course, do that at home. You could hide bits of kibble around your house or your garden. I'd probably recommend the garden, in case dogs always generally find all the kibble, but I understand that people don't want to just be spreading kibble around their house willy-nilly. That could get a bit, you know, I can see why that wouldn't be ideal. But definitely you can have toys that you can put treats in, like sort of mousse or paste treats, which take a lot longer for the dogs to get everything out of. And some of these can even go in the freezer. So you can kind of put some of the, like, peanut butter paste or the special paste that comes with them, then pop them in the freezer. So again, it's cool. So they could have that when they're outside in the evenings or outside early morning. So there's loads of things that we can do. Lots of treats, homemade treats you can make that are frozen, that again will just help keep them a bit cooler, and they can go out with you on a walk. Well, I suppose they could get a bit soggy, couldn't they? But I'm sure you can make it work.
Loads of options, and really can't state this enough. This is really, really serious as we come into those hotter months. So please, just because you're not feeling too hot doesn't mean your animal isn't suffering. And of course, there's always indoor daycare. We've got dog swimming parks now. Of course we do.
Yeah.
Get the paddling pool out.
We have such a huge range of paddling pools available to us. You know, there must be something that your dog would like.
Oh, Jarvis, our dog, loves the paddling pool. We'll cry when we have to get him out of it. So have some fun, do it responsibly, and do get in touch if you need any advice relating to heat, especially if it's urgent.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
We've got Dr. Hannah Rolls with us this afternoon of the St. Vincent Group on hand to take your questions, and lots of cat questions coming in. Elisa wants to know, what's the earliest age for cats to be neutered? She says, given I've had kittens that have got pregnant approximately 3 to 4 months, they were strays, so she's not exactly sure. What are the guidelines around recommended age of neutering?
Normally we would say 6 months, but that's when we're talking to people who have a kitten who is a pet. Absolutely, we will do it earlier, especially we will do for this sort of the stray population. It's unusual to come into season and to be able to get pregnant at say 3 or 4 months of age, but then, you know, that it's not impossible, and we wouldn't want to miss that window of opportunity that we've got to perform the neutering and avoid any unwanted litters. Mm-hmm. So when we are working with sort of TNRs, the trap, neuter, release, when we've trapped them, we tend to go by weight and use that as a good estimation that we're happy to put them under anaesthetic and do the procedure. And that will for sure be in kittens that are about three or four months of age. It's no problem. It's common practice. So if you're concerned that your animals come into season, or if you're worried, if you're monitoring, you know, your garden cat, or you're looking at a litter of kittens that have come there, just bring them into the vets and ask for their advice. They'll tell you if they're happy to do it or not.
Brilliant. Thank you. I hope that helps, Lisa. Better to be proactive on these things. Absolutely. And Salim wants to know, we do have a lot of cats that wee in really inconvenient places on this show. It seems to be a bit of a common theme. But this cat likes peeing in the wash basin, even though his litter tray is right underneath the basin. What can you do to stop this one, Dr. Hannah?
As always, the urinary situation is a complex one, isn't it? And what we're always trying to figure out as vets is whether we have an actual medical condition or whether we have behavioural. And sometimes that can be a bit difficult to work out. And that's where your visit to the vet and your urine sample comes in handy to try and rule those things out. But also a good history. So something for you to think about is if anything has changed in the household, if you have a cat that is prone to this kind of thing, as in a stress response for them would be to change their urination habits. Have you changed the litter tray or the position? Have you changed the litter that you use? All of those things you could try and change back before you seek out the vet. But definitely, if you've had guests, that could be enough for your cat to be like, nope, not going to use my litter tray today. I'll go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Anything, even if you don't think it's a big change for them, it could be if you've a new baby or a new kitten or a new dog or something like that. Any of those things could also be causing the problem. But the best thing to do is go to the vets and let us double check that it's not a medical problem. It's not like a cystitis that's causing irritation and making them pee more frequently. And then talk through it with you and see if we can work it out as well from a history.
Okay, really hope that helps. Frustrating and probably a bit smelly, I am sure. I was speaking earlier about the importance of keeping our cats and dogs cool and comfortable and entertained. And I meant to ask, and thank you, Mark, for flagging this, about grooming. He has a pug called Prue.
I love it.
Isn't that lovely?
Short for Prudence.
I hope so. My bike is called Prudence. So Prue the pug, would it help with the heat to clip her coat? What do you say around grooming? Are some animals simply able to cope with the heat with their natural coat, or can cropping it all the way back really make a difference?
Now, I'd say there's mixed opinion on this, and it depends very much on the breed of dog. So some dogs have what we call the double coat, which is, for example, I think Huskies do have this double coat, which is designed to insulate them and trap the air and keep them warm. But it also provides some sort of reflection for the heat as well. So a lot of groomers will say, please don't clip them back, because they do have some natural protection for that. And then also, of course, when we're talking about the sun, we are talking about the heat that we get from the sun. But also, particularly if you have a dog that has quite white skin underneath and white fur, we would be worried if you clip really, really close that they're then at risk of sort of having a dermatitis and a burn from the sun if they're out in the sort of direct sun exposure. So I would say have a chat with your vet and with your groomer and see what they recommend in their experience, depending on what breed you've got and what kind of coat your dog has. Because yes, it can definitely help with cats. I think especially the outdoor cats that are long haired, we do tend to kind of clip them back, leave them enough to protect their skin, but so that they're not carrying that big sort of heavy coat around. Definitely have a chat with the groomer, have a chat with the vet, see what the best thing is for your pet.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Hannah.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
And our expert of the hour is Dr. Hannah Rolls of the St. Vincent Group. It is quiz time for you, Dr. Hannah. We're going to have a quick fire round on collective nouns for animals. This is all sparked because I recently learned that a group of wild rabbits is called a fluffle. And it made my day about 400% better. A fluffle. Okay, so I'm going to name the animal. You're going to see if you know the name for a group of them. Okay, we'll start easy. Bees.
All right. Oh, are they not a hive of bees?
It can be a hive or a swarm. Fish.
Of course, yeah, fair enough. A school of fish.
A turkeys.
Oh. A goblet. No, it wouldn't be a goblet.
It would be good. That would be a great one. It's a gang of turkeys. I think that sounds really intimidating. Crows.
Oh, I know that one. That's a murder of crows.
Owls.
A parliament, because it's my favourite one.
Very good. My favourite one, flamingos.
Oh, it's not a flock of flamingos then, presumably.
It is a flamboyance.
It is.
A flamboyance of flamingos. And lastly, do you know what? I'm going to give you two more. Porcupines. I can't resist this one. A group of porcupines is called a what?
I know this one because I think we've played this game before and I didn't know it last time and I would never forget after you told me. It's a prickle.
A prickle of porcupines. Okay. I don't think we've had this one before. Giraffes.
I would have said a herd.
It's a tower.
No?
It's a tower of giraffes.
Of course.
Yeah, every day's a school day. Even a highly educated vet can learn something, a thing or two. Going to the text line, much loftier calls on 4001. One question that came in on the phone line, but they didn't want to have a chat, asking how often should you bathe a cat? Listener wanted to know it's 2 or 3 times a month that she's doing it. Cat really doesn't like it. Is it necessary?
The short answer to that is no. I have only bathed Mr. Sneaks if he requires it, and he does go outside. So very occasionally he'll come back and he'll be like sandy or mucky or dusty or whatever, and then he has a bath. Or he's occasionally rolled in something sticky. I don't know why you would do that, but and you can't ask him what it is. So anyway, then he's had a bath. That's not something I would do regularly. And so for cats that live indoors, I think if they're long-haired cats, we would say, you know, focus on grooming and brushing and making sure that they're not getting matted. But no, definitely. And whatever with dogs or with cats, I always say, unless they have a skin condition and the vet has prescribed you to do something differently, do not bath them more than once a month, because we do sort of strip the natural oils off of their skin and we can irritate the skin if we're bathing them too frequently. Cats groom themselves, and normally, you know, especially our short-haired cats, they're very, very good at doing it. So it's not something that you should be doing on a regular basis.
Good news for everyone.
I've told you different. Oh, yes.
Don't put yourself or your cat through it if they're not enjoying it.
Risky occupation, I'd say.
Yeah, okay. I really hope that helps anyone out there who's doing some cat wrangling. Maria wants to know, why are my cat's eyes always watery? Is it a symptom of any problem?
Not necessarily. Some breeds of cat, depends what the sort of discharge looks like. If it's watery and it's clear, it could be completely normal. Some of our cats, especially some of our pure breed cats like Persians, do have sort of they produce more tears naturally, and that's perfectly normal. As long as the eyes are not inflamed, they're, you know, nice and they're always holding their eyes open, their eyelids nice and wide, they're not irritated or rubbing, and they don't look reddened, then I wouldn't be worried. When we get worried is when that discharge has a colour, so it's like a yellowy-green colour or seems sticky, and, you know, you have an eye that seems very sore and inflamed and it's bothering the animal, then that isn't normal, but it could well be perfectly normal.
Okay, hope that helps, Maria. Great question here, and something I think a lot of pet owners kind of worry about is losing that vaccination card. Message on 4001 saying, how can I update the vaccination card of my cat if I lost it? Even the microchip details are on that card. What can I do?
It will be logged at your vet's. So the vaccination card we hand out once we've vaccinated for you, so that you have that information if you need to travel or if you are going to cattery or kennels or daycare. But we also have all of that information, so the batch numbers of the vaccines, when the date, the microchip number, is all held on your veterinary practices system. So they will be able to issue you a new card, or they'll be able to issue like a certificate of vaccination. So don't panic, just let them know that you've lost it and they can reissue you some sort of document that gives you all those details.
Okay, brilliant.
Do not panic.
And coming to, you know, I like a name on a message. I don't mind if someone doesn't put their own name on. I do like to know the animal names. Cozy and Boozy, two cat sisters. My question is, at night, as soon as we turn the lights off, Boozy starts meowing loudly. Of course, it's Boozy that's the problem. She gets toys from somewhere, wants me to play. It becomes really disturbing for us. Please let me know, can this be stopped somehow? Boozy problems, what can we do?
Oh, I am not the best person to ask this because Mr. Sneaks is a bit of a nocturnal creature, and he's definitely much more active at night, particularly in the heat. And it is, we have to remember that it is their natural, you know, our cat's natural behavior to be more active at nighttime. So you can try altering the time that you feed them both in case you think that it's to do with hunger. If it's to do with playing, you can perhaps try and have a more organized, intensive play session when everybody's up and everybody appreciates it rather than when just Boozy appreciates it and everybody else is trying to sleep, and see if you can adjust the behavior that way. But it is something that can be a bit tricky. If you have possibly things you can add to the environment, so maybe cat trees, somewhere that she can investigate, and she's got more space to roam herself, maybe she would bother you less. But I would try that, see if you can have a more intensive play time with toys and try and wear them out before bedtime.
Okay, let us know, report back, because a lot of people are reporting very similar problems. And as you said, Dr. Hannah, sometimes it can feel a bit seasonal as well. Riette's been in touch saying, our cat Sylvester, amazing, eats my daughter's rubber play mats that's on the floor. Any idea why? And I think I know the one you mean, that are kind of about a centimetre thick and they kind of fit together like a jigsaw piece. And our dogs loved scratching them, actually, when they were puppies. But this Sylvester likes eating them. Why would that be? And how can we get them to stop?
Why is an interesting question. We'd probably try and have to ask Sylvester, but I imagine it's because it kind of feels good rather than it tastes good, being a rubber mat. In the same way that dogs like to chew flip-flops, I think they're quite satisfying to chew, but it's obviously not ideal at all, and we would be quite worried about if he's sort of just chewing up and making a mess. That's one thing, but the risk is that he would ingest some, and that can, you know, be a bit of a foreign body. And if it's foamy as well, you know, it could expand and cause a bit of a problem. You can try maybe the sort of bitter sprays that are available that are supposed to give a bit of a taint to the mat, and might dissuade the cat, might dissuade Sylvester from having a good chew, but also try and physically stop that contact. So roll the mat up if it's possible and remove it when you're not there to keep an eye, and when your daughter's not using it, and maybe tuck it away, because sometimes they really like the feel of things, which is why with cats we worry about string toys and balls of yarn, things they like to play with, and they like to have a good chew on them, and they are all a risk of causing a foreign body if they are ingested. So avoidance as much as possible if you can.
Okay, I hope that helps, and yeah, I like it. You might need to ask Sylvester. Anonymous message here saying, I recently kitty sat my friend's kitten, but it had fleas. Do I need to clean all my stuff, or will they just die without a host? Oh, makes me itch. So fleas without a cat, well, what happens to them? They just keep on bouncing around? What can this listener do?
I'm afraid you do need to treat the environment as well, because they do survive for some period of time off the host. And they tend to be what we call photophobic. So they kind of hide underneath sofas and things like that where it's dark. You can get products that are designed to treat the environment. And of course, the best place to ask is your vets, because we're used to treating both your animals and your environment. So even if you do not have a cat, go down to your local vet and explain the situation and see what products they would recommend to treat the house. Keep doing what you're doing with vacuuming, and wash everything that you can wash, so, you know, bedding and that sort of thing, and a hot wash should be more than enough. But yet there is a risk, and there is environmental contamination, which we can deal with. So pop into your local vets and ask them for their advice.
Okay, I hope that helps. Sue just been back in touch about that lost vaccination book, saying, I asked the vets, but they said they don't have the details about it. It's from the vet clinic, from the adoption. Oh, no. Tricky one.
You could go back to who you adopted your pet from and ask which clinic they used. And they should hopefully have the records that say, however they identified your animal, because obviously they may not have called your animal the same thing that you have done since you've adopted them. But there should be a way to track, if possible. So I would keep trying, because all your vet clinics will have a record. It's just that we might not know which vet clinic vaccinated them for the adoption centre. Good luck.
And a question here saying, is it okay to give human food to my cat once in a while? She likes to give us a begging look every time we order chicken and we can't resist her look. Okay. Is this when you're honest and you are putting on Dr. Hannah vet hat? Or is this where you are equally honest and are the Mr. Sneaks' mummy? Come on, human food for cats, Dr. Hannah. Which side of the fence are you on?
Shall I give two answers?
Go on. The official answer and then the truth.
The official answer is this is not recommended. We'd be worried about, say, the salt content of the food that we've prepared for humans compared to for cats. Plus, obviously, you know, what we think is a treat size for a cat is probably the equivalent of like a packet of biscuits rather than just the one biscuit, or a burger instead of just sort of a piece of your burger. So you need to bear that in mind. So we don't recommend doing it frequently. And then it would be a lie if I said that occasionally Mr. Sneaks hasn't had like a corner of sausage or something like that.
Okay. Thank you for your honesty. Yeah.
Do not do it frequently.
No.
Your vet will be cross.
The calories will add up and you'll have a fat cat.
Yes.
Dr. Hannah, thank you so much as ever. Lots of messages this afternoon. We're picking a winner next to that Royal Canin goodie bag. Dr. Hannah Rolls and St. Vincent Group wishing you a wonderful, I was going to say weekend ahead. Keep on thinking it's Thursday. If
nearly.
Only. Nearly. We're hanging in there, love. All right, speak to you later. Bye-bye now. So many messages. Apologies if we didn't manage to get to yours this afternoon, but don't forget Pets and Vets is with you every single Wednesday.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
This hour, we are meeting the authors who are making a difference in society in their own ways. We are meeting now someone who wants your kids to explore the UAE, where they call home or their second home. Not just the shiny side, you know, the malls, the hotels, but the hidden wonders, and really get under the skin of their, well, it is their home for many. We've got International Day actually at school tomorrow and my kids are still very confused about where they're from, and rightfully so. But really to get an understanding of traditions, of heritage, of the heart. Amika was joining us this afternoon. Amika is the founder and lead writer at Green Feet Guides. She is a nature-loving globetrotter, a teacher, environmental planner and a mum. She's lived with her family all over the world, Asia, Middle East, Europe and the US as well. Amika, thank you so much for being with us. I've had a look at your books and they are just so charming is the best possible way I can think of describing them. Where did the idea come from? You're an educator and you've chosen to write books that would serve as a bit of a cultural guide, but why did you feel like that was a bit of a gap?
So thank you, Helen. I'm delighted to be here today with you. And I basically am I'm a teacher married to an American diplomat. And so we move around the world every 2 to 3 years with our daughters. And every time we move, that new country becomes my classroom as a teacher. One thing I love to do more than anything else is to explore new cultures and landscapes with my children. I see it as a wonderful opportunity for them. And so I started, when we were living in Singapore, I started writing Greenfeet Guides, which I think of as a world adventure series, book series, to help my kids get the most out of their experience living in different places in the world and traveling the region. And then I wanted to share it with other families.
And you've done a Dubai guide, and you've also done one for Cambodia as well. Which one came first?
Cambodia came first, and it was inspired by our explorations of the Temple of Angkor Wat. And I was really thinking, how do I make this 1,000-year-old temple interesting to my children, my daughters who were 5 and 7 at the time? And so I created a scavenger hunt for them to look for things around the temple. And we shared stories about all of the carvings that were engraved on the temple walls. And that was just a fantastic experience. And that's when I realized that the combination of stories and activities, including treasure hunts and giving kids a purpose when they're out and about in the world, that can really make a difference to their learning and just them having fun when they're out and about and being excited about these places. I think we take our children to a lot of places. We spend time and money doing that, and it's a wonderful opportunity to learn. And with just having a little tool, something for them to focus on, can really make that difference.
It can make a huge difference to them, but can also make a huge difference to us as parents. If they're enjoying themselves, if they're occupied, if they're not doing the like mum, I'm bored, and they're hanging off you and asking for snacks and wanting to go to the gift shop, or, you know, go back to the hotel pool, or whatever that looks like.
Yes, absolutely.
I say that from experience. My mum worked, I do honestly, my mum worked for English Heritage in the UK, which is a bit like the National Trust. And we every weekend used to get dragged around what my dad called were like rotting piles. So lots of Roman ruins, basically.
Yes, exactly what you described was what I observed when we were at Angkor Wat with our children, who were my kids were having fun with their treasure hunt, and I saw many families who were struggling with, Mom, can I go back to the hotel swimming pool? It's hot. And I completely understood, and that's when it dawned on me that stories and activities and a purpose can really make a difference.
And it really can. You know, I think a lot of people, and I would include myself in this, can feel a bit hesitant about taking kids to cultural places, whether that is a museum or, you know, you're talking about Angkor Wat there, because I'm a bit unsure about how they're going to behave, if they're going to be disruptive to other visitors, to, you know, locals who are there to show people around or to enjoy them themselves. But if there is a focus, it can make a huge, huge difference. When it comes to, I mean, is there an appropriate age to take our kids to these kind of places? Or is it a case of if we don't do it, we won't try and they won't get used to it?
Honestly, I think I've been traveling with my kids since they were babies. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they didn't have much of a choice when they were young. But no, I don't think any age is too young, really. I think actually when they're younger, they're sort of, I think, much more open, and they're excited about everything. So I think starting as, you know, as young as possible, as long as, again, there's space and room for them to roam and explore. You know, there are certain places that are more conducive to that. But I don't think there's a minimum age to start. And the younger you start, the more excited they can be about the place. They just have a different experience when they're younger and when they're older. I think kids, when they're older, you know, maybe need a little more of a hook, a little more of a sell. But they also remember more of what they discover on the journey. So any age, I think, is very valuable experience for kids to have.
And Vicky, you've written the book for Cambodia. You've also written one for here in Dubai. So if anyone has any recommendations for their favorite kind of cultural hotspots, for maybe it's for you as an adult and you haven't taken your kids yet but you'd like to, or you just want to share your recommendations, please do get in touch. Many families will be staying here in the UAE over the summer, Ambika, and I wondered, from your experience exploring and as an educator, can you give us a couple of your top destinations for, let's say, under eights, because that can be the most challenging age when it comes to getting them entertained?
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, there are so many. I know with the summer, you're probably looking for more indoor activities. But I find the Old Dubai, the Al Fahidi district, is a wonderful place to go and explore. There's the Sheikh Mohammed Center for Cultural Understanding, and they have these wonderful cultural meals where you can go and they talk a lot about traditional Emirati culture. Of course, food is a wonderful way to engage kids. So because there's a meal there, they can try on the traditional Emirati dress, they can enjoy foods. It's a very open, welcoming environment. They have a new heritage bus tour, so they can take children into the mosque. They have the Camel in the City there. So that's, I think, a really good spot. And, you know, honestly, I think it's about go wherever you are. Emirati culture surrounds us. Often we just don't know to look for it. So even if you go to the mall, you can have a traditional Emirati cultural experience there. For example, you can, in the activity book, I have a treasure hunt. And one of the things when you're armed with this treasure hunt to look for is spot an Islamic geometric pattern. And it's a great thing for kids to do. These patterns, I'm sure you've seen them everywhere if you're looking for them. They're in the malls, they're in the hotels, they're in the parking lots. And you can have your kids look for these patterns and spend 5 or 10 minutes just looking at them. It's a beautiful shape, but what are the little, you know, the squares and the circles, what are the small, simpler shapes that make up this traditional Arabic design? At the mall, you can go to a date shop. Dates are a traditional Emirati food. They have been consumed and part of the staple diet for thousands of years. Go to the date shop and examine how many different types of varieties there are. So I think it's really, you can do it at the mall. You can go to the Al Fahidi district. going to the Emirates, the other Emirates, I think is a fantastic way to explore. Sharjah has the Museum of Islamic Civilizations. And again, if you go armed with a purpose, let's say you tell your child, let's go and let's look for an astrolabe. An astrolabe was the world's first, the first clock, the first GPS. It's the way people told where they were in time and their location by looking at the stars. So I think it's often giving them a purpose, something to do that can really make the difference. And the other thing I'll just add to that list is there are some incredible wildlife centers which are you can actually experience from indoor, the wildlife from indoors, the Wasit Wetland Center in Sharjah. And there's the Mountain Conservation Center also in Sharjah, and it's an indoor experience, but you can see all the desert animals in their habitat, and it's the desert is so key to understanding the traditional Emirati culture. So I think there are many, many opportunities there. And I will say that I have on the Greenfeet Guides website a free download, explore and learn tips of places that families can go with recommended ages. And there are a lot of ideas there as well.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In conversation with an author, a globetrotter, a teacher and a mum as well. Ambika Anand Prokop is here. She's the founder and lead writer of Greenfeet Guides, which encourage you and your family to go out and be in the world, explore what might be a destination, a holiday, or indeed here in the UAE, what could be your home or second home with a good dose of fun. What age group do you think the books are aimed at, Ambika?
So I have two books. As a teacher, I know that different kids have, at different ages, they need different things. And so I have a book for the Dubai UAE Kids book is really for ages 4 to 8 or 4 to 10. And then we have the Dubai UAE Explorer Guide, which is 8 and above. And they cover very similar content, but just in a different way. Obviously, the book for younger kids is just simpler. It has a picture story. The whole book can be a coloring book. And again, very interactive, but simpler material, simpler drawings. The older kids book is quite, has a lot, it's much more dense. It has a lot more information. Again, lots of activities, puzzles, crossword puzzles, crafts. Aimed at that higher age group. And I will also say I market it as 8 to 99 because I've had so many parents tell me that they've really learned a lot and had fun reading the Explorer book as well. So I think it's for all age groups, anyone who has an interest in learning more about the traditional culture and the landscapes here.
There's, and lots of messages coming in asking for your advice, to be honest. I think a lot of families have decided to stay here in the UAE. We did the same last year and honestly had a really wonderful summer kind of discovering and falling in love with the UAE all over again, whether that was staycations in Rak or days out here and there. Sarah says she's just moved to Dubai and wants to know, is there anywhere nice to go that has animals that treats them well? I think that second part is really, really key. What would you say there in terms of family-friendly places, even in the heat, that you can go along and either see or interact with some furry friends?
Yeah, absolutely. I know it's a little bit tricky still to get in and out of Abu Dhabi, but I think the Al Ain Zoo is fantastic. I think, and it has the outdoor component, but it also has an amazing desert learning center. And I really, really, my kids have really enjoyed their time there. I also think, and this might be for a little older kids, but the Abu Dhabi Falcon Hospital is really interesting. They do a tour, maybe 8 and above, but you see the falcons and you can see a falcon surgery or a falcon pedicure. I learned so much there about falconry and how these birds.
Did you say a falcon pedicure?
It's really quite extraordinary place to go. And as I mentioned, the Sharjah, I think, has some really, really nice wildlife. Any of the wildlife centers there are set up really well. There, you sort of view from indoors during the summer, and then there's an outdoor component when it gets cooler. So I think those are all very, good places. And the other thing, of course, again, this is not the season, but going to a camel race, a camel market, that's such an interesting experience. Al Ain has a good one, the Al Marmoon racetrack. yeah, really, really interesting ways to have camel experiences.
Well, we will definitely revisit this when the weather cools down again, September time, to see when that season's starting. Speaking of Sharjah, Emily wants to know, do you know if the rain room in Sharjah is still open? Have you been there, and do you know if it's still possible to visit?
I have been there. I actually don't know if it's still open, but it was a wonderful experience. It's a short experience. It's great for kids. It's a small space. But yes, I don't know if it's open right now.
Thank you so much, Ambika. Really, I think honestly, it's a case of looking at where we live with fresh eyes. And, you know, I've said it before and I'll say it again. It really breaks my heart when I have tourists come to Dubai and they don't maybe leave the hotel, or they go back and say, yeah, it was great. You know, we went to, you know, Debenhams.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah,
that's I completely understand.
I feel like you've kind of missed the point.
One thing for all the parents who struggle out there is let the kids be the guide too. As a teacher, I can say this, the kids will have the most fun and will not protest as much if they actually buy into the idea. Mm. And one of the purpose of writing Green Feet Guides is they really are for kids. And so the kids can flip through, they can see on the treasure hunt, where do they want to go? You know, do they want to go greet a camel? Do they want to find a falcon? Do they want to smell some oud? And I forgot to mention, I think the perfume museum is outstanding in Dubai. So if you flip through the book and the kids say, hey, and you notice that they're interested in something, that's going to make that conversation and that experience so much better for everyone, because the kids are vested and they can be your guide because they would have read something in the book perhaps that they want to share with you as parents. So there's an opportunity. The parents don't always have to lead. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really why I wanted to write Green Feet Guides, to empower the kids to kind of be the guides as well in this new place.
And then become ambassadors for the place that they call home. Thank you so much, Mika. Really, really appreciate it. You can find Green Feet Guides online.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Meeting the author now this afternoon, and I'm very intrigued by this book. It's called The Granddaughter Project, and it's by British Indian author Shaheen Christie, who is sharing the experiences of three very different women who collectively, through this book, use their voices, aiming to improve societal attitudes for their granddaughters. And the men around these women, who play really prominent roles in their lives, put them into desperate situations. It's an original fiction novel. It sounds like something that could well, hopefully, change attitudes and maybe change the world. Was that the aim, Shaheen?
Absolutely, Helen. Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to speak at your show. And as you know, that I was born in the state of Rajasthan in India. And I was fortunate enough to have seen first eye experiences of women, how they were treated and how they had their day-to-day lives. And then after that, I have spent 37 years in London, where I had the exposure of a much more liberated society. And I think that sort of grounded me in a way and enabled me to write about these three characters in The Granddaughter Project. And it really is my attempt to highlight the issues and sufferings of the previous generations of women. Mm-hmm. And with the perspective of their granddaughters learning from it and hopefully not repeating those sort of mistakes. And it's an eye-opener, really, from my perspective. And I think it is really something that everybody should welcome and should read about it. And I think that's really very important, especially for men, to be able to understand where things are going wrong and how we can correct it and what sort of society we want to live eventually.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because it is, with respect, quite unusual to have a male author taking on a subject such as female empowerment and looking for more of an equal society and addressing, as you say, things that haven't been done well or properly or justly or fairly or have been done violently in the past. How important do you feel it is for men to be an ally when it comes to this kind of empowerment for women across all countries?
I think it's very important that we both work together, both sexes work together on this to achieve this empowerment goal that I'm setting myself. I really was very lucky to have had mother and sisters and friends in India as well as in England, where I grew up, to they actually inspired me. And I felt that just because you're a different sex, why should you have to have different standards to go through? And why should the doors be closed on you just because you happen to be different sex? To me, we are two hands in a body. One is a man and the other one is a woman. And we should have equal opportunity, just like both hands work in tandem to be able to achieve good things. And I just feel passionately about this subject, and hence I came to writing this. This was in my mind for 20 years. This story developed a long time ago in my mind, and I wanted to write about it and sort of enable people to question various aspects of the society, how we're dealing with women, and whether we are at least addressing some of the issues that are prevalent in our time, and have we learned anything from our past? And that's really what I've tried to do in the Granddaughter Project. And I hope everybody, via through your show, as well as your recommendations, read the book. And if there are any suggestions, we're happy to take the suggestions and work on those to pass on the message, really.
It is a bit of a cautionary tale, but it's also an inspirational tale as well, you've said. Can I take you back to your native India, and what kind of obstacles or attitudes are in the way of women being treated equally?
Yeah, I think there are a number of problems for women in the Indian society, or in any other society which is evolving, really. I call one thing, which is the school leaving examination in India, I call matric examination. I think I call the matric syndrome, which is basically when this whole question of marriage arises for women, and they're only about 16, 17, 18 years old, and everybody's looking for a suitable partner for them at that very age, where they are actually finishing their GCSEs. And from then on, they're under pressure to sort of like tie their knots to someone. That was one. And the other thing was that there was, I mean, I grew up in Rajasthan, which is, as you may know, it's a desert state. And I saw women going for miles and miles just to get the water for their families, the sacrifices women were making. It just got into me, and I thought, you know, it's such an unfair way of doing things. And you know, a woman of 17, 16, 18, she's not, forgive me for saying it, she's not in a position to be able to make a grand decision of a marriage. And I think they need time, education, careers, empowerment, really. And I think that's why I wrote this. And I think it's very, very important that we work on that. I mean, I say that the voting for women started in the early 19th centuries, but real power hasn't really touched women, because in all the parliaments in the world, still men are prevalently the ones who are representing them. And I think that's what I would say.
Oh, I know. I wanted to ask you, Shaheen, if you could, and I guess my frustration with not your book specifically, but even, you know, on the show when we're talking about the importance of putting children in, let's say, put them in car seats, for example, I would imagine that most people that listen to Dubai, I know this. I'm not necessarily accessing the people that need to have that information and be able to make a change. And I think the people that would pick up your book will already be, you know, fairly, you know, I guess will have their eyes open to a lot of the issues that you're addressing. But how can you reach the people that perhaps are the ones perpetuating these outdated traditions that really are keeping women down?
Well, I think those thoughts have to be challenged. And I think I was talking earlier the other day with a friend. I think there has to be universal allocation of 35%. That's what I believe should happen across the world. 35% of all jobs, all appointments should be to women, irrespective of skill sets. A lot of my English friends have talked about it, and they said it should be based on skill. But I think it should be a universal thing. 35% should be allocated to women. I don't say 50 yet. Eventually, the goal should be 50. But I think 35%. And I think we need to challenge the attitude of men who are living in the old ages, and basically bring them to understand that basically women play a crucial part. I am here because of a woman, really. She gave birth to me. She suffered 9 months of pain and agony to bring me to this world. And I'm grateful to her for that. And I think we need to recognize those things. I have a wonderful sister. I have wonderful friends. And I think they play equal part, if not better part, in the society overall than men do. Men have been great warriors, but I think the real warriors in this society are women, because they really carry the family, they really carry the city, they really carry the country.
And we know that in communities, if a woman is doing well, the community is doing well.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing a new book this afternoon called The Granddaughter Project. It is the work of a British Indian author called Shaheen Tisti. It's been decades of thought now put now on the page, which must be quite an intimidating process, Shaheen, after thinking about this. And you've taken a real deep dive into the suffering of women throughout history. What has it taught you, and what should it teach society?
Well, I think we can take a number of lessons from it. Basically, we should create a fairer society. We should create equal opportunity for women. We should definitely, the most important thing is give them equal rights in all sections of life. And also women need to be represented in every organization. We have to remember from a multinational company or any government organization, the consumer end of the day are 50% women. So a multinational company must represent, have the representation of women there, because this will lead to better product development, which is the end consumer end of the day. And I think that it is about high time that we address this issue, that women are allowed to vote, women votes count, but the women representatives are not there in the parliaments. And I think we need to change that. The real power must belong to the real people, and that includes women and men both. And it has been far too long, just men, men, men. Even if you look around the world now, 170, 80, 90 countries, you're only going to find 5 or 6 women as a premier of those countries. I think we need to change that. And it's about time that women took more lead in that and we provided more opportunities for them. And I think we need to challenge the society from all angles. And it is going to be a revolution. And I think that definitely need to come now, because I don't want my granddaughter to suffer in any way, shape, size.
Thank you so much for this, not only for starting the conversation today on the show, but also through your book as well. And I'm not saying it's going to happen in my daughter's lifetime, but maybe in my granddaughter's. And it does take people. But I would say really important to hear from men who are there fighting the good fight alongside women too. You can find the Granddaughter Project. More information online. The author, as I said, Shaheen Kisti. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Emily Jenkins, she's joining us from Do Not Travel. Lovely to see you, Emily. We are sorting out some travel dilemmas this afternoon, talking about the latest news, of which there is lots at the moment when it comes to travel corridors opening, flights being started, reinstated. You are the head of leisure at Donata Travel. We have been hearing lots of travel news. As you've just heard, chances of the UAE being removed from the UAE's red list on June 7th is unlikely. But Dubai Airport's Chief Paul Griffiths is hopeful of, he's saying, good news in the immediate future. He was speaking to the Business Breakfast Show today and explained that the situation is very complicated and that the two governments are exchanging data rapidly. Griffiths is, however, hopeful that things will change in the UAE's favour soon.
I hope that the example that we're seeing with other countries will actually make the UK government sit up and think actually travel between the UAE and the UK can be made safe with everything that we've done to make it so.
Griffiths admitted that while travellers can feel frustrated, governments are currently exchanging some really vital health data to ensure that both countries remain protected.
Around the world, politicians are prioritising the medical security of their domestic populations. Now, having said that, it's immensely frustrating for those of us who would love to travel more and have been, you know, 4 billion people on the planet have been under lockdown for more than a year. It's a shame that really we can't get things moving quicker.
But it does seem like UK travellers are booking and planning late summer holidays kind of in the hope that the UAE will be placed on that country's green list. Flight bookings from the UK to Dubai more than doubled in the last week of August. That's according to travel analysis Forward Keys. Emily, are you seeing this? When what kind of hotel bookings are, what kind of trends are we seeing?
Yeah, sure. I think like everything that's happened in terms of travel over the last 15 months, there's a lot of time speculating around what's going to happen and hoping things are going to change. I even remember last March when this first started, people were cancelling their summer holidays or moving them to October or December or towards the end of the year, being hopeful that things would change. And, in 15 months on, we're still in probably a very similar place. We focus mainly on outbound travel, the part of the business I look after here, so people booking to go overseas. I think it's been a long time. People are wanting to reconnect with family, and I think, just trying to focus on what is open at the moment and all of the good news that we've received this week around places in Europe that are coming online for us is very much where we can see customers booking and getting excited about. So, I think, Dubai and the UK has always been a popular, to go both ways. So I think people are hopeful for the end, but, things are changing constantly. So
I'm not holding much hope out, to be honest, but that also comes from a place of me would rather go on holiday than go to the UK.
Yeah.
Do not tell my mum. I've just sent her an email last night going, so disappointed as well, mum. Honestly. I want to hug her. I want to see my parents. I just don't necessarily want to do it in England. We are seeing lots of different news and announcements coming through. We're going to talk about Italy very soon. Emirates announcing just today that from the beginning of July, there's going to be 4 flights per week to Phuket, adding to the roster. And for those who are vaccinated against COVID-19, it's going to be what they're calling hassle-free travel, no quarantine on arrival. So let's look at travel to Italy from the UAE. When is this going to be kicking off?
Cool. So, yeah, so as of from today, effective 2nd of June, you can travel to Italy from the UAE. The Emirates already have flights, I believe, 5 times weekly to Rome that are currently operating. And also from the 1st of July, they will be starting to fly to Venice as well. So I think between with Emirates, there will be flights to Milan, Rome, and Venice traveling. The nice thing with the flight to Milan is that it also, they do an onward flight from Milan through to New York. So you could have a look at doing, a double stop with that one. And I believe that Fly Dubai have also announced today that from the start of July, they'll be flying to Naples. So it's very easy to in terms of regulations. You just need to have a negative COVID-19 PCR test. That's valid 48 hours prior to departure. And then you're fine to get on that flight. And once you arrive there, you do also need to have a test on arrival. I believe it's about 20 euros in Rome and 32 euros in Milan. And then there's an online form to fill in.
So that's the practical side. Yes. This is where you get to take us, transport us to Italy with some, I don't know, what kind of deals, what kind of hotels? Is there anything good on the Donata website that would get us excited? And I just want to eat some Italian food in the Tuscan sun. What can you offer up?
Sure. So we have a really great 11-day holiday package staying in an Italian villa at Villa La Borghetta Resort in Tuscany. This includes breakfast, 11 days car hire and return economy class flights into Rome. So all of that per adult, you're looking at 9,995 dirhams and 4,625 dirhams per child.
All right. So this is Italy.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And to help us, we have got Emily Jenkins with us. She's the head of leisure at Donata Travel, offering up some great deals, the latest guidelines, and on hand to take your questions too. And we've just been discussing travel to Italy, now open from the UAE. So what about Spain? Can you shed some light on, do you need to be vaccinated to travel to Spain from the UAE, Emily?
Yes, you do. So from the 7th of June, Spain will reopen to vaccinated tourists from any destination. The vaccines that will authorised are the ones from EMA and also the World Health Organization. So that does cover off on, Sinopharm, Pfizer, the ones that the majority of the population here have been vaccinated with. If you have children who are unvaccinated, they may enter Spain with a PCR test, and children under 6 are exempt from the testing. So again, you do need to be vaccinated to be able to go to Spain. And there is some online forms that need to be filled in as well once submitted to be able to board the flight.
We're getting good at admin, aren't we? We're getting very good at the travel paperwork. You just got to fill it out. Think about that sun lounger or those beautiful sights when you get there. Question here saying, hi there, how about Portugal? Will it be open for the vaccinated? What do we know about Portugal travel from here in the UAE, Emily?
Sure. So Portugal from here is only open for essential travel purposes. So that's, you'd need to prove, if it's business travel or something like that. And at this stage, that's the requirement to get in there. So we don't have any updates currently that Portugal will be opening to us, to tourists anytime soon. But we're obviously always staying on top of that.
I wonder if I could be like, I'm going to go and look at buying a house there in my dreams. There's got to be a way of getting into there. Just come back to Spain, because I did see one of the deals that you've got on the website in Donata Travel, which was a 12-day Spanish adventure. So hiring a car, travelling Spain, and it includes, I'm not going to do any accents at all, Barcelona, Valencia, Murcia, Granada, Seville, Cordoba, Madrid, and flights as well. So brilliant way of seeing, it depends how good your kids are in the car, I would say.
So I actually did this exact holiday in 2019. Yeah, and it was fabulous. It was one of the best holidays I think we've been on. I didn't have children at the time though, so I can't speculate on that. But being able to, you know, this holiday also includes car hire. So that those 12 days, including the car hire, the flights and all of your accommodation, is 9,085 dirhams per adult and 4,275 dirhams per child.
I think for lots of people at the moment, I don't know if you remember, we did Croatia a couple of years ago, and I planned that holiday within an inch of its life. I don't want to think about how many hours I spent. It was worth it. It was 100% worth it. Absolutely loved it. Would love to go back. By the way, is Croatia, I'm waiting for Croatia. Any news on that, Emily?
Yes. So with Croatia, the issue at the moment is just that we don't have direct flights going there. So there's no quarantine required, and it is open for tourists. So you could pop into a next door neighbour and drive across if you wanted to.
I think what kind of freaked me out a little bit about that holiday is there were just so many moving parts. It was like, we'll have two nights here, we'll have one night there, we're going to drive to there, we'll get the ferry here, blah, blah, blah. And what kind of would worry me now about doing a trip my own on that kind of organised basis, if it becomes like a house of cards, you know, one thing falls apart, then everything's out of whack. Whereas this is, it's like an organised adventure. Does that make sense? You're kind of having a bit of whimsy and a bit of exploration, but it's controlled fun. It's fun within a structure.
Yeah. It's really interesting if you have a look actually about what customers are booking with us at the moment. We're seeing that length of stay is increasing to, it's about 30% up on previous years, but we're finding that customers are staying put. So they might fly in and stay on one island in Greece for a much longer period of time rather than bouncing around. And I think all of that is to your, you know, exactly to your point, just the thought of, you know, by the time you've got all your paperwork at the airport and you've gotten yourself to your destination, you know, I think the thought of moving around again and possibly having more, you know, regulations for some people can just end up being a bit overwhelming. So, again, that's what we're here for. We know, you know, I know everything sounds complicated, but, you know, we can help you with all of that in terms of booking all of your arrangements, PCR testing, insurance, you know, transport, hotels, flights. So.
What I'd also say is it stops that constant question asking, which I had from my husband, being like, what's in the travel file? Where are we going today? I'm like, look, guess what? Someone else has organised it. Don't look to me. It's not my fault if this hotel's atrocious. Yeah. Going to the text line, Sai was asking, any sign of Oman opening up? I know a lot of people are desperate to escape the UAE heat and head up to Jebel Akhdar to some of the lovely hotels up there. Any news?
No, sadly, no news. No. We don't have any timelines at the moment as to when Oman will be opening.
Oh, sorry, Sai. We will, of course, keep you posted. We've got Emily Jenkins with us this afternoon joining us from Donata Travel. Mike asking, and he hasn't got back and told me what the final bill was, saying, any good deals on all-inclusives in the Maldives? Can't face the dread of checkout after last time, travelling with two teens and a wife. Teens can eat. So I can only imagine the eye-opening experience that bill must have been. Any good deals on all-inclusives? Is that something that Maldives is pushing right now?
Yes, we've got some excellent deals. So we have an offer at the moment for Summer Island in the Maldives. So this is including your three nights, flights, your speedboat transfer, and all-inclusive in terms of meals and beverages. And that there is 5,995 dirhams per person. And then we also have another great deal for the Sai Lagoon Maldives, which is a Hilton property. Again, it includes three nights accommodation, flights, speedboat transfers, and meals and beverages. That one there is 7,110 dirhams per person. The cool thing about that property is that it's connected by a marina to the Hard Rock Maldives as well. So you can actually move between the two hotels and, you know, see some different sites and hang out on the marina there as well. So that's also a great option, especially with teenagers.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking travel this afternoon, Emily Jenkins with us. She's the head of leisure at Donata. It is such a tricky time, one of much uncertainty of people going, right, we're going to book it and let's just keep our fingers crossed. Or other people going, I just can't decide what to do. I'm just not going to book anything and just I'll decide something last minute. So I think the more information we can get, the better. Obviously, Donata Travel, keeping everyone really well updated on all the travel guidelines, plus some deals as well. Amina wants to know, is there any sign that Japan could be open to tourists? What do we know about the Far East?
So at the moment, we don't have an update or a timeline for Japan, sadly. I know, obviously, there's been the Summer Olympics we're talking about coming up in July and other things, but at the moment we do not have a time frame for Japan, sadly.
Unless you're an Olympian, in which case you probably should have your tickets booked. Lots of questions about specific destinations. One about the US. Ali wants to know, is it worth travelling to US right now, especially when the prices have doubled? It was 4,000 dirhams per person before the pandemic and now it's touching 8 grand per person. When do you think prices will stabilise to normal again? What are you seeing on the price front when it comes to the US, Emily?
I guess that's a tough one, just in terms of, you know, obviously the more people that start to travel and the more airlines that open up for travel, obviously, you know, more competition on a route always helps with pricing. But we're still seeing some great offers coming through to get across to the US. I know at the moment we have got a great deal to Miami in Florida, where you can stay 4 nights at the Gale South Beach Curio Collection by Hilton in a signature room, including return economy class flights, is about 5,921 dirhams per person.
So that's accommodation and flights for just shy of 6. Okay. Oh, there we go, Ali. Hope that's something. And no name on this message saying, how is travelling to Russia these days? What's Donata saying and are there any deals?
Russia is actually one of our top booked destinations at the moment. We're seeing huge amounts of customers wanting to go across to Moscow mainly and a bit to St. Petersburg as well. So in terms of Russia, I think we've got a really great deal for the Novotel in Moscow. So that's 3 nights there in a superior room, breakfast daily, return economy flights for 2,515 dirhams per person.
Wow. Wow, that's really interesting, because I think there are some of these deals would perhaps encourage you to try some of that might not necessarily be on your like travel list initially. But we're in strange times and you're seeing bookings across destinations that might not have been traditionally the most popular destinations from here. You know, with the likes of your Serbias, your Montenegros. And, you know, think of this as being a bit of an opportunity. Last question. Layla got in touch earlier saying basically she thinks the summer's going to be a bust. Her words, not mine. Saying we're going to book some staycations instead, maybe one longer, 4 or 5 nights. Would appreciate Emily's recommendations for a resort that has villa or room with a private pool. Thank you. Can you help Layla out? And then I'm going to let you get back to your busy day, Emily.
Sure. So recently, my husband and I actually stayed in Ras Al Khaimah down at the Ritz-Carlton Alhambra, which is right on the beach. It's a beautiful hotel. So we do have an option there for the tented pool beach villas. And that there for the Ritz is 3,855 dirhams on bed and breakfast per night. There are some other options as well. So I know there's a great four-star called the Jana Pool Villas in Ras Al Khaimah. You can actually get a three-bedroom pool villa there for one night for two adults and two children. You're looking at about 3,548 dirhams, including bed and breakfast.
Or go to Russia for less for nearly half the price. Amazing. All right, really hope that helps. Emily, thank you so much for your time. All of these deals and a lot more, especially when it comes to staycations, are up on the Donata Travel website. We'll have you back in a couple of weeks. May well be speaking to you before then as more and more gets updated. It is exciting times, but we do need the experts to keep us informed. Otherwise, I think my head might fall off. Emily Jenkins, thank you so much for joining us from Donata Travel.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking travel this afternoon. And if there is one headache, several headaches, this pandemic has brought us expats in the UAE, is that ever-changing travel situation. Government's obviously acting to protect their citizens from COVID-19, but it means that making plans is incredibly difficult. When the pandemic started last year, a lot of people who had booked flights, holidays for the summer, had to go through that process of cancelling, rebooking, postponing, or trying to get a refund. And I guess this is a problem that a UK-based app is attempting to solve. It is offering something of a unique service to flyers here in the UAE. The app is called Colibra, and we're joined now by Caligin, joining here as the CEO, to explain a little bit more. Trying times, how are things in the UK today?
Hello.
Hi, can you hear
Hello.
Me?
Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Yes, I do hear you quite well. First of all, I'm not in the UK. I'm right now in Zanzibar.
Oh.
Zanzibar, I'm building a resort here. So
come
it's like
on.
This is another of my ventures.
I've only just met you. It's amazing how quickly you can go off somebody when they tell you they're in Zanzibar. So tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Tell us then about.
Right on the beach now, sunny and beautiful.
Stop it. Stop it. Now, I'm a big fan of any business or service that is solving a problem, that is there to help. And this is very much a problem that's been unique to the pandemic, you know, for the last year or so. Many people, as I say, rebooking or cancelling flights, asking for a refund, going through all the headache, admin, being put on hold. So tell us about the app then. How does it work?
Well, Colibra is actually an application that we launched about 1 year ago in Europe, and it was a service based. It is a service based in the European Directive 261, which is on for cancellations and delays. So we do operate only in Europe this service, which is for cancellation and delays. But now we are launching a new product, so we start selling tickets, airplane tickets, and hotels, rental car services, just about everything which is related to travel. The way we do is a bit different because of what happened now internationally. So there is a big headache for the customers when they are buying anything about traveling because they cannot predict what is going to happen. And we believe this is not fair for the customers. That's why we start selling in a bit different way. So what is different about this way? So imagine, I'm going to give you an example. This is always the easiest way to imagine. So imagine you just want to go somewhere. What do? You go to a website or somewhere. So you pick a date, you pick a destination, then you pay, and then you travel. So if everything goes okay, then you're happy. If you have a problem, then you got to go and look for your rights after the airline and maybe use your lawyers or whatever. It depends on the airline strategy. So if they're going to do a quick refund or what they're going to do with you. So you got to go chase your rights because you already paid, so you're in a situation to chase. What do we do with Colibra in a different way? So you just come to Colibra website or application. You want to book a flight and travel somewhere. So what you do is you pick your date, you pick your destination. Then what is amazing about it? You don't pay.
Oh,
you
don't
pay in this moment.
I like not paying. Okay, when do I pay?
Yes. You fly wherever you want in the world. Then you land on the other side. So imagine we have two scenarios. Scenario number one, everything is okay. Then you receive a message. Dear sir, ma'am, everything is okay with your flight. Thank you for flying with Colibra. Now we are going to charge you whatever the ticket price is. The ticket price is exactly the same. There is no extra charge for the ticket price. This is what is very essential to know for Colibra. So if you go, let's say, to Emirates website and the ticket price to a particular destination is $1,000, so it is $1,000 with Colibra as well.
Okay, that's good.
So then you pay after the flight. This is absolutely essential to know that this is first one-of-a-kind service that is will allow you to pay after the flight, post-paid, instead of prepaying your flight. But what is more amazing about that is what happens is in case there is a cancellation or a big delay. So imagine you fly, you have, for example, a big delay. Then you land on the other side, there is a big delay, you receive a message. Thank you for flying with Colibra. We didn't charge you, and we never will.
What?
So we thank you for flying for free. So you just don't pay anything. Because we believe that the flight shall be okay, you know, you only pay if okay. And this is the name of the service. It's Colibra Pay If Okay. You only pay if you are happy with the service is okay. Of course, there is a definition for okay.
I was going to say, not to reveal too much about myself, I have got not a criminal mind, but definitely a devious mind. Are there any loopholes that people could be exploiting?
Not really, because actually we are coming from insurance and everything is like quite well calculated. So we are doing everything on the so-called actuarial mathematics, which is actually insurance mathematics. So we're calculating the risks, etc. But how it works in the deeper details, what happens is that in the beginning, when you want to fly with Kolibri, of course, you're providing your credit card. Mm-hmm. So then you sign a contract that in some particular case, you're going to be charged, and in another case, you're not going to be charged. Let's say with your delay, if there is a delay of more than 3 hours, we don't charge you. If there is less than 3 hours, we do charge you.
All right.
So this is the case. So you fly, we don't charge you in the beginning. So we land on the other side, and there is no argue about this. Because there is international regulators which are actually following this all these flights, so we know what exactly is the delay, and we are following the flight in real time.
A completely different way of doing things. People asking, what is the app called? It's Kolibri. It's C-O-L-I-B-R-E. Oh, A, sorry. C-O-L-I-B-R-A. Kalajin there speaking to us from Zanzibar. Hope he got a good deal on his flights and hope he paid his bill at the end of it.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.